Numbers chapter 26. Well, here we have the second census that is taken of the people before they enter into Canaan. This is taken, verse 3, in the plains of Moab by the Jordan at Jericho. Now, what was the purpose of this census? You could say that Moses, as the good shepherd, had counted his sheep in the first census when they left Egypt at Sinai, and now he's sort of counting them back in at the end of the wanderings. Well, you could take it like that. Did God actually need to know these numbers? Well, of course not. He himself knew all the numbers. He knows everything. So I think it was for the benefit of the people. These are those, verse 4, that came out of the land of Egypt. Well, it wasn't literally the people who'd come out of the land of Egypt, because they'd been, 38 years wandering in between the two censuses. So I think one of the reasons was because God wanted the people to be all in family units when they entered into the land. Psalm 68 says that God set the solitary in families. That was the case at the Passover, and it was the case, I think, here at the entrance into the land. Why was that? Well, it shows that God values family life and for the family unit. I think it's also because the intention was that each family possessed a unique part of the land. The exact detailed list of who got what is not actually preserved for us, but I think that that clearly was God's intention. Because quite a bit of the law of Moses reasons on that basis, as if every family had their unique inheritance. That is why it was not allowed to sell your inheritance. That is why, by all means, the inheritance must be preserved within the family. It's why they weren't to intermarry between the tribes. And you think of the business with Naboth's vineyard, where he says to Ahab, I can't sell you that which is in my family line. I can't. I must preserve the inheritance. And that looks forward, I think, to how, in the kingdom of God, we shall have our unique inheritance. We shall be given a stone with a name written on it that nobody knows apart from ourselves. As Job says, after I'm dead, worms will eat this body, and yet in my flesh I will see God. He clearly believed in the resurrection of the body, whom I shall see for myself and not another. I take that to mean that nobody could quite enter into his eternal, personal, future relationship with God. And this is indeed the case for all of us, and we can reflect upon the idea of being in families, that there could well be the idea of eternal groupings of people. Perhaps those people who are in your life now, within the wider people of God, who are your family, be they friends on social media, be they whoever, people in your local church, people possibly in your natural family, if they are also believers, the believers that are in your life now may very well be the group, as it were, that you're involved with eternally. Now, that has huge implications for getting on with each other now, for forgiveness, for acceptance, and for never ever rejecting any one who's in the people of God from your spiritual family. Temporary discipline, I understand that, but ultimately none of this closed table business, you can't come, you get out, and all that sort of thing, in the spirit of Diotrephes, who we read about in the third letter of John. He refused those who accepted the missionary brethren and cast out of the church those who would accept them. So then, these are the people who, verse 4, came out of the land of Egypt, and it's the same word for brought out. They were brought out. And we just pause to take some encouragement from that, because actually Israel didn't want to leave Egypt. In Exodus 14, when they complain, oh, there's nothing to eat here, we want to go back to Egypt, they say to Moses, isn't this what we told you in the land of Egypt? Leave us alone. We don't want to leave. You forced us to leave. We didn't want to leave. Of course, they did on one level, because it was no fun being slaves to the Egyptians. And yet, as we're told, in their hearts they returned to Egypt. that's where their hearts were, and they complained often that the food was better there, let's make us a captain and return, and etc. So then you can see how, in fact, it was by grace that God brought them out. He, as it were, forced through his program. And the whole crossing of the Red Sea, Paul says, is like our baptism. They went through the Red Sea with a cloud of water above them and water on both sides of them. That was like a baptism. And it's the same with us. We are brought out of this world and taken on the journey towards God's kingdom, in a sense against our will. And yet, of course, there has got to be willing collaboration later on in the journey, because those who truly did not want to be in that kingdom were not, because in their hearts they returned and they did not believe. So, next point, verse 14. The families of the Simeonites. Well, if you compare the figures given for the tribes in Numbers chapter 1 with the figures that are given here at the end of the 38 years wandering, you'll see that some tribes decreased and some tribes increased. Now, Simeon decreased by 37,100. That's a really major drop, and you wonder why. Well, in Numbers 25, that we've just read, we read that 24,000 people in Israel were killed for committing fornication with the Moabites. And who was the ringleader of that move towards Moab? It was Zimri, a prince of the children of Simeon. So it's quite likely that as a Simeonite, somebody from Simeon was the leader, quite likely that his tribe eagerly got involved in all this fornication with the women of Moab. So that would have the ring of truth to it, that yes, a lot of those 24,000 who were slain were in fact from the tribe of Simeon, which would explain why they so dramatically decrease in number between when they left Egypt and when they entered into Canaan. People ask me why I believe the Bible, why I believe in God, and I always say, well, you wouldn't quite get it, but it's the little things. And it's little things like that which have the ring of truth to them that internally corroborate the story. Though those are the things that for me are the big things. Other people like to focus upon, I don't know, wonders of creation or fulfilled Bible prophecy and so forth. Maybe it's just me, but I have never been sort of bowled over, as it were, by those things. I'm not saying they don't have relevance or appropriacy. I'm just talking purely about myself. That to me, it is the mass of little things, of little internal corroborations that give the whole thing about God, about Jesus, about his word, that give it all the ring of wonderful truth. It's rather like when you look at the list of some of these names, you're struck, say verse 15, Zephon, Haggai, Shunai, etc. You're struck by the lack of any reference to the name of God in those names. And when you look up what they mean, a lot of them are just purely secular names. Yeah, this would be reflective of how they really were, I suppose, in the wilderness. Well, finally, verse 34, you read that of the families of Manasseh, there were numbered 52,700. That's a pretty huge rise. They started off 38 years before being numbered of 32,200, and now there's 52,700. If you look at Ephraim, there was 40,500 of them when they left Egypt, and now, as they're entering into Canaan, there's only 32,500. So then Ephraim's gone down and Manasseh has gone up. You remember when Jacob was dying, he tries to make Ephraim, who was the second born out of Ephraim and Manasseh, he tries to make Ephraim the firstborn and says there's going to be greater blessing upon Ephraim than upon Manasseh. Well, that didn't actually happen here, did it? And I think that those blessings of the children that were given, for example, when Isaac wants to bless Jacob and Esau, and Jacob on his deathbed wants to do the same, blessing Ephraim and Manasseh, these were not the Abrahamic blessings. These were sort of secular best wishes. I wish you the best, my son, because I'm dying and whatever, from men like Isaac and Jacob. And I think that Jacob, of all people, should have learnt that really the fatherly blessing was not of the essence. What was of the essence was the blessing of Abraham, the blessing of God. And you know how he lied to his father when his father was blind, pretending he was Esau to get the blessing, how he'd really ripped Esau off of his birthright, the business over the stew. And later on, when Esau comes to get him, as it were, when he's fleeing from Laban, he says to Esau, he gives him huge material presents, and then he meets him and he says, take away, that's definitely what the Hebrew means, take away my blessing, because I have all and abound, because last night I met God and God was gracious to me. So at that point in his life, he understands it, that look, I've got God's grace, so I've got everything. So I don't need all this, you know, dad's blessing and all that stuff. Take it away, I don't want it. He got to that point where he realized this, and yet he didn't maintain it, because at the end of his life, he's still mucking around with Ephraim and Manasseh, crossing his hands over their heads, trying to ensure that the second born gets the most blessing. And I don't think God was in that at all. That was Jacob at the end of his life, still imperfect. And you see here in the growth of Manasseh and the decline of Ephraim, how really his intention that Ephraim should have the greater blessing, that it just didn't come true. And that, I think, is a warning to us, because there are times when man comes down very small before God. And that's, of course, what Jacob did that night when he was preparing to meet Esau. And he says, "Now take away the blessing. I don't want it. I was wrong. I was misfocused all the way through." And yet when he's older in his life, he has not maintained that level of understanding that all this material stuff is neither here nor there. We also, at times, come down very small before God, and that's how we've got to remain. But God only gives you those opportunities to come down small before him every now and again. You don't get a cancer scare or whatever that brings you down very small before God. You don't get that every, you know, every week, every month or whatever. These sort of things happen just occasionally in your life, and you're brought down and you've got to stay down. That's the idea. But we have, as humans, this tendency, like Jacob, and I think David was the same after the thing with Bathsheba. You come down small, but then the old tendency to pride and materialism and human secular thinking, I'm afraid, is a very strong tendency within us, and it can easily arise again. So stay down. That's I think the lesson from that.